Well, so I am not going to talk so much about my own work in this talk, but rather give a little survey of some of the interesting mathematical work that has been recently done, especially by Kevin Costello, which has been motivated by ideas from topological field theory in two dimensions. And I guess my hope is that this may give those of you in the audience who are physicists some sense of pride that this formalism is proving so stimulating to mathematicians. But also I want to tell you maybe in condensed form some of the ideas that I've learned from the physics community in a way which is a more mathematical development. So I'm going to start with just what is an open topological field theory in two dimensions. So so as you know, if we have a field theory, then and we have a surface like this, this is a disk with some pieces of its boundary marked out, then we get a number, a correlator. And we can also think of that in terms of having two open states coming in and one out. So if we think of A and B coming in, we get AB coming out. Now, of course, in a field theory, the actual out state will depend on the metric on the surface and perhaps on other geometric data. In a topological field theory, it's meant to just depend on the topology, and the disk doesn't have very much topology. So we just get a product. And as everybody here knows, this product is associative. To see that, we draw a disk with four states on the boundary, and we divide it in two different ways, and that shows it as its correlator is two different compositions, but in two different orders. So I don't know, shall I give you the picture? So this is representative of everything that I'm going to do. In this talk, but of course, what I'm going to be talking about is somewhat... people locked out. It's going to be a somewhat more complicated discussion than just mere associativity. So my inspiration for the first part of this talk was lectures I heard by Greg Moore on his work with Graham Siegel here 4 years ago. He was talking about open-closed topological string theory, but in a very sort of degenerate setting of semi-simple associative algebras, whereas we're going to be looking at the homological algebra, which is more relevant to more general cases. So, and the other property that we have for this associative algebra is that it's Frobenius. It has a non-degenerate inner product, and the we have the following relation: AB inner product C equals A inner product BC. This is in some sense proved by the same picture as, this is proved by this picture because we just take different in and out states, and they're given by the same correlator, so they must we must have this identity. So this is also called a cyclic structure. So a cyclic associative algebra. That's a somewhat redundant term, but the word cyclic can be used in more general situations, and I'd like to talk a bit about those now. The fact is that when we say topological field theory, I should underline the word topological, we're interested in far more than just the set of the set of components of the space of correlators. Here we have, you can imagine a space of all possible conformal structures on the disk or something, and what we're just doing here is saying, let's just take one physical correlator for each component of that space. And there's much more to topology than pi naught. In particular, there's pi 1, the fundamental group, and there are higher homotopy groups, and in particular, we should certainly put the idea of homotopy more central than in this very naive argument. So we should pay attention to homotopies. So in this context, we led immediately, or Stasheff was led immediately to the theory of A infinity algebras. And many of you will have seen talks in which these arise. They're now well known to occur very naturally when studying open topological strings. So this is due to Stasheff, and it's a set of bookkeeping which essentially keeps track of the fact that in the moduli space of disks with four points on the boundary, we can degenerate it in... And here I'm going to be thinking in terms now of a conformal structure on this disk. We can degenerate it into this very degenerate conformal structure where there's an infinitely long half neck or sort of ribbon between the two disks. And we can do that in two different ways. And the set of conformal structures on this disk with these boundary points is actually an interval which joins the moduli spaces of these configurations, which are just one point each. So we get, this is the moduli space. It's the first non-trivial example of a Stasheff polyhedron, or an associahedron, as they're often called. So to a topological field theorist, the idea is that these two correlators are equal on physical states because when we integrate along, I'm a bit afraid to use the physics terminology, but something like we insert a G minus state, integrate along this contour, and that shows that these two correlators differ by a BRS exact quantity. So that's the very simple idea, and as I said, Stasheff was able to expand on this and give a full structure in which we have more points on the boundary of the disk. And the next one that comes along is the pentagon. So the pentagon is associated with the case where we have a disk with a conformal structure. I should maybe warn you that Stasheff didn't talk about conformal structures on disks, but it turns out that his construction can be reformulated in terms of such. And if you look at this, let me just give some illustration. There are five different ways to degenerate this disk into a pair of disks, and then five ways to degenerate it into three disks. But let me just give one sample degeneration. In which, say, the first and the second marked point bubble off. And now, this configuration has two ways to generate, because this disk can't degenerate any further. It's only got three points on its boundary, so its moduli are fixed. This guy is a one-parameter moduli space. It's just a copy of this, and it can degenerate in two ways. I'll just draw one of them. So that's a sample picture of how our correlators, how we can, this guy gives a homotopy between this and the other degeneration, and this guy, it's two-dimensional, and it kind of gives a two-dimensional homotopy between all those one-dimensional homotopies. So the picture is as follows. The resulting moduli space of 5 points on the disk in this cyclic order is just given by a pentagon, and I'll leave it as an exercise for you to label all the strata of this pentagon by different configurations of disks. But instead, let me show you how it's related to the problem of associativity. You'll have probably seen something like this before. We start with four states, which we multiply in from left to right. And what we'd like to know is how that's related to the result of multiplying from right to left. Now, at the level of physical states, we already know that it's going to give the same answer, but it'll give the same answer up to something which is BRS exact. And the pentagon gives us actually a homotopy between the two proofs that they're... So down here, let me... work a bit on this diagram. So here I've done one association. I've, instead of multiplying AB by C and then by D, I've multiplied CD by C on the left and then by AB. And then we can do another association operation. We get to here. So this is the opposite multiplication order. And if we go around these two sides, we can obtain a homotopy. The difference between these two states will be BRS exact by some explicit formula. But we can go around the other side as well. We'll get a different exact state, and then by integrating over the pentagon, we get a formula for the difference between those two exact the states, the boundary of which is the homotopy in these cases. So just to finish the picture. We have that pentagon. And the story keeps going. The next stage, there's a very beautiful picture on the front cover of a book by Schneider and Sternberg, which shows the diagram that you need to draw if you want to understand the associativity for five different things. And if you're very good at woodwork, then you can build one of these for yourself by taking a tetrahedron and shaving off three of the edges by a plane, and then cutting off two of the corners, and you'll have yourself your own model of a associahedron. Okay, so I want to generalize this to higher genus. That's the first topic of my talk today, and introduce some moduli spaces which were basically laid out in Melissa Liu's thesis. Melissa. You. So she introduced these moduli spaces, which are generalizations both of Deline-Mumford moduli spaces, which are suitable for studying closed topological gravity or closed topological string theory, and these associahedra. So I want to first of all define them. My notation's a little different from hers. In fact, I'm still struggling a bit with what the best notation might be. But these moduli spaces are moduli spaces for conformal structures on a surface of genus G with H holes, N marked points in the interior, and on each of the H holes we have K1, K2, K3 respectively points, and on the ith hole Ki marked points. Now, I have to confess, although in her thesis she considers the case where some of these Ki can be zero, I have to say that I don't fully understand that case well yet. For example, if all of the Ki are positive, then we can distinguish between the different holes just by paying attention to which marked points are on them. But if you have different holes which have no marked points on them, then strictly speaking, we can't distinguish between those holes. And according to the dimension count I'm about to give you, it would look like such a hole is a fermion, and I haven't been able to understand that. So any help would be very greatly appreciated.
So your points are ordered and labeled?
They're going to be ordered and labeled, yes. Yeah. I'll show you in a second. A hole with no marked points on it. Yeah. So I don't know. Well, we'll see. If you allow some of the Ki to equal zero, then you get into the discussion of what are called boundary states in the closed sector. And one can discuss that, but I don't quite understand the grading involved at the moment. So this moduli space has dimension. There's the dimension of the... If there are no holes, then we already know its dimension. And then we get an extra 3 times the number of holes plus the sum of the number of boundary marked points. And this is all I meant when I said it looks to be a bit like a fermion. If all the Ki's were zero, then each of the holes has a dimension 3. And so it looks like a fermion to me. But is that too naive? It's called the sign convention, that's all. If I switch two holes, labeling of two holes, then the sign of the correlator changes. That's what I mean. So somebody has to explain this to me. Okay, and it's empty unless we have a stability condition, which is similar again to the usual one, except there's a contribution from the boundary that this number has to be zero. Positive, sorry. Okay. So it turns out that introducing these moduli spaces, we actually can completely capture the first part of Greg Moore's lectures from 4 years ago. He gave us a set of axioms which were discovered by Llewellyn for open-closed topological string theory. And these axioms, which involve a Frobenius algebra on the open sector, a commutative Frobenius algebra on the closed sector, and some axioms relating them, they now are hidden inside the structure of these spaces, and I'd like to show you that. Okay? So this is meant to be strictly pedagogical. Now, let me make some observations about how one can construct these spaces. The most efficient way to do it is to take the surface that you're considering and double it along the boundary holes. So you take another copy of the same surface, but with the conjugate orient. Well, if you're going to think of these as complex manifolds with boundary, take the conjugate complex structure. If you're thinking of them as oriented conformal manifolds, take the opposite orientation. And then glue along the boundary the boundary pieces. And so then, when you're done with that, you're left with a closed surface with some marked points and with a reflection on your surface, an anti-involution. It squares to the identity and changes the orientation, and which exchanges some of the marked points, which are the doubles of these internal marked point, interior marked points, and it leaves fixed some of the marked points, namely the ones which were on the boundary before. And then you study the moduli space of compact Riemann surfaces with marked points together with an anti-involution, and in that way you can produce these moduli spaces. So I could say a lot more, but I'd like to stick to higher value material in this talk. So let me instead go on and give some illustrations of these spaces. Am I allowed to use this board? Yeah. And so let me give, first of all, identify some of these. So if we're looking at genus 0 with no interior marked points, and some number of marked points on the boundary, k marked points, well, strictly speaking, I have to tell you a cyclic ordering of these marked points on the boundary, because this actually has k minus 1 factorial components. That's the number of cyclic orders. Then this is naturally identified with the Stasheff polyhedron k minus 1, I think it's called usually. And this has dimension k minus 3, real dimension k minus 3. So for example, if k here is 5, then we get the pentagon. Or strictly speaking, we get 24 pentagons. So that's the first interesting example. And now suppose we have a marked point in the interior. Then remember what we have to do to construct this moduli space. We take a disk and we put a marked point in the interior and k marked points on the boundary, and then take the quotient with respect to SL2R acting on the disk. SL2R has three real dimensions, which is where this minus 6 plus 3 is coming from for one hole. So we can use up two of those parameters to move the marked point in the interior to the center. And then we're just left with a rotation. So we have k marked points on the boundary, modulo rotation, and you see then that we're left with a configuration space of points on the circle, and when you compactify it, you get exactly what is known as the cyclohedron. So this is WK. This is Bott and Taubes's cyclohedron. So these are very pretty polytopes also. They're also convex polytopes. Maybe I should have mentioned that. Each of the Stashev polyhedra are convex, can be realized as convex polytopes, and likewise for the cyclohedra. And for example, W1 equals a point, W2 equals an interval, and W3 equals a hexagon, and so on. Exercise. I doubt it. Yeah.
Isn't there a generalization of this bottom covers for MONK, the M point in the interior?
I don't know. They're no longer, certainly they're
they only look at the case with one point in the interior?
Oh, yeah. They only look at that case. We'll, in a moment, we'll look at two points in the interior. That's all we'll need to do today for Moore and Siegel.
But weren't they finding this structure by looking at like diagrams or like the ones that Nikita was showing the other day? Like they were not doing this in terms of when they were studying configuration integrals.
Absolutely, they were interested in were interested in link invariants.
Yes, exactly.
So their idea was that integrals over these guys were exactly link invariants, and I think that's very stimulating that they occur just automatically when you set up correctly the open-closed string theory. So I'd like to see somebody make use of this, you know, draw a more direct link. But in any case, I should say that this is a very difficult subject to actually make rigorous headway in the sense of constructing the open Gromov-Witten invariants. Fukaya, Ono, and Ota have worked very hard to construct this part of the theory, and I'm not even sure of the current status, whether they've constructed successfully the correlators which involve integrating over this part and actually getting an A infinity structure in the Fukaya category rigorously. Then once you did that, you'd like to then go on and construct integrals over these polytopes which would give you a pairing between the Fukaya category and the Gromov-Witten sector. So that really remains to be done. So part of the talk today will be that in some sense these are the only two cases that really matter. So I don't understand the extent to which that idea is true, but I'll let you decide at the end of the talk. So now, if you take the Deligne-Mumford moduli spaces, they're stratified spaces because you start with some complex manifold and then you glue lower dimensional complex manifolds onto it in order to finally produce a compact complex manifold. And the story here is somewhat similar, except that there's a combination of gluing along analogs of divisors, except in a real setting, and also gluing boundary pieces, corners, on. And so in any case, these moduli spaces are stratified spaces. They're actually manifolds with corners, but they also have a stratification of inside their interior. And so I want to just introduce the notation SKD MGN bar K1 up to KH for the D-dimensional skeleton. So the zero-dimensional skeleton is just those strata in the moduli space which are zero-dimensional. The one-dimensional skeleton is just the union of the one-dimensional skeleton and the zero-dimensional, the one-dimensional strata and the zero-dimensional strata, and so on. So by the time you take D equal to the dimension of the moduli space, you have all of it. And so in that way, we get an increasing filtration on these spaces. And And so in this way, I can now state the result of Llewellyn, which was cited by Moore and Siegel, in the following way. Huh, how do you spell Llewellyn? I'll spell it correctly, but I don't know whether he spells it this way.
One too many.
Which one? This double L, this initial double L is famous. That is, that's incorrect.
No, the beginning is correct.
Ah. Oh, the second one is only one. Oh. Yeah. This is apparently some very weird letter in the Welsh alphabet. Oh, no. I should have done my homework. Anyway, the theorem is that the inclusion of the second skeleton into the whole moduli space is a isomorphism on components. So if I take pi naught of both of these spaces, I get the same thing. Every two points which are in the two skeleton and which are joined in the moduli space can be joined inside the two skeleton. That's essentially what Llewellyn's theorem said. And to recover the details of his theorem, you only need to work out what the two skeleton looks like. The reason I like saying it this way, so this is a bijection on components. So the reason I like saying it this way is, first of all, because it then clearly generalizes a similar statement in the theory of Delina Mumford. One of their points was that if you take the Delina Mumford moduli spaces and take the union of the zero-dimensional strata and the complex one-dimensional strata, that's already connected. And that's the same statement as I'm generalizing here to the open case. It's interesting that you need to take the two skeleton, not just the one skeleton. But the reason you already need clearly to take the two skeleton when there are no boundary pieces, just in the closed sector. Because you need to take the WDVV equation, if you like, and that corresponds to looking at something in the two skeleton. So I'm going to illustrate all that now. But I wanted to, as I said, phrase it this way because obviously it lays the stage for asking more complicated questions. So I'll just very briefly indicate what the two skeleton looks like. Just like in the closed case, the strata are products of open pieces of these moduli spaces. So to classify the 0, 1, and 2-dimensional strata, I only actually have to find which of these moduli spaces are 0, 1, or 2-dimensional, and just look at them. And those will give me the basic identities in topological field theory. Okay? So the idea, maybe I should have said, the point I should be making here is that in topological field theory, the idea is that each component here is determining one correlator, because we can homotope between any two points in here and get up to a BRS exact quantity, the same correlator on physical states. And then the statement is that actually we could have just done it by moving along the two skeleton. So first we have the zero-dimensional moduli spaces, and those are M003. This is just the moduli space of three points on the boundary of a disk, and this gives the product in the open sector. Let me call the open sector A. It's some, as I said, associative algebra. It's actually a Frobenius algebra, or maybe if we're if it has BRS states and so on, and we're looking at it before taking the physical states, then it's an A infinity algebra. Or to be more accurate, if there's more than one boundary condition, it's a category. But let me just say it's a associative algebra. Then there's M011. This is the first cyclohedron. And this gives a pairing between a A and C. So let me call A the open sector and C the closed sector. So, and let me call, well, we can consider the pairing to be a map from A to C or a map from C to A, which is the adjoint with respect to the inner products on those spaces. I think my notation may be a little different from Greg's, but let me write it like that. So we have an operation which goes from the open states to the closed states, and then its adjoint goes in the opposite direction. And finally, we have the moduli space of three marked points on a sphere, and this is the product in the closed sector. Then we come to the one-dimensional moduli spaces, and there are two of these. This is under the hypothesis that every hole has some marked points on it. So there'd be more operations in the theory involving what are called boundary states if I allowed holes with no marked points. But I haven't yet, as I said, understood completely the story there. So we have, this is the next associahedron. This is just the interval. And this produces associativity of the product on A. And then we have the moduli space. This is now the first cyclohedron. Maybe I should have said this is K3. This is K. This one is now W2. This was W1. And that is also an interval. And this tells us that this operation from the open to the closed sector is a trace. What you get is that the moduli space is an interval, and the two ends are the trace of A times B and the trace of B times A. Well, let me try to be systematic. I'm calling open states XY. And so this moduli space gives a homotopy between trace of XY and trace of YX. So that's the one-dimensional story. And for the two-dimensional story, I have three moduli spaces. There's actually one that I'm going to skip, because once you have... I could include them, but basically at this point they'd give no further connectivity, so I don't need them. But these three that I'm going to write down, I need. So three are needed. And in addition, there are two more. K4 and W2, W3, not needed. For the theorem. I'm just adding extra connective tissue, which doesn't make the skeleton any more connected than it already was. So these are as follows. No further relations, that's it. Yeah. These two are not needed. The pentagon and the hexagon.
In CFT you say only these conditions, you work so far, are enough to specify.
No, I still need associativity in the closed sector, for example. I haven't even done that yet. Maybe I should have mentioned here the product is commutative in the closed sector. That's automatic from the structure of the moduli space. There's M0, 2, 1. So this is the moduli space where we have a disk, two marked points in the interior, and one marked point on the boundary. And this is actually a disk.
You mean supercommutative or commutative?
I mean supercommutative. And in a moment I'm going to start systematically just dropping all signs from all my, and when I start giving formulas. So this moduli space looks like this. This is a picture of the different strata in this moduli space. And the point is that the stratum in the middle, if we didn't include this moduli space in the game, it would just be all on its own. But because we've glued in this moduli space, it connects this point to this stratum to this stratum. And these strata, what this says is actually that the adjoint of the trace is a homomorphism of algebras. So here we have tau upper star of A times tau upper star of B. In the middle we have tau upper star of AB, which equals tau upper star of BA, because the product in the closed sector is commutative, and down here we have tau upper star of B times tau upper star of A. So that's a very simple moduli space. Then we have the familiar one, M04 bar, which is just the WDVV equation, effectively, or associativity in the closed sector. And finally, we have the moduli space of annuli with one marked point on each boundary component. And that, this is the Cardy condition, the relation that it gives rise to. And I won't write down the Cardy condition now, but I'll show you the moduli space. And I'm told that this is well known in some sense.
This one.
Okay, so this is, so the generic one is a disk with two marked points in the interior and one on the boundary. Now here, the two marked points have bubbled off. So I have a sphere with these two marked points, and then it's joined in the center of a disk, and then here's my boundary point. So that's what's going on in the middle. Now what's going on the these two strata is that the disk is breaking up into a pair of disks, each of which contains one of the interior points. That's one way to put it. Another way to put it is that if we draw it's a bit confusing because at this point it becomes hard to distinguish the things that we're taking moduli of and their moduli spaces. But you have to try. Okay. It's worth the effort. The easiest way I find to understand these degenerations is to draw the curves in the cut systems in the interior along which we're contracting. So for example, this case is obtained by drawing this contour, this curve. Whereas these two are instead obtained we have to draw something like that. So actually I made a mistake. This degeneration is into three disks. And there's another possibility where this point instead is at the top. And so the basic maxim is that for a closed contour, the dimension goes down by 2, and for an open contour, one that goes from the boundary to the boundary, the dimension goes down by 1. And if you put it in the double, then actually this closed contour doubles to two closed contours, invariant under the anti-involution, and this becomes a pair of closed contours. And a more general way to put it is instead that the dimension is going down by the number of contours in the double. The double gives a very attractive way of seeing why one of these contractions is only worth half as much as one of these.
But on that picture, they look like they're both in codimension 2.
These are both in codimension 2.
Oh, right.
This one is this guy, and this one is that guy.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and the purpose of this moduli space in the proof of the theorem is to give a homotopy between these two degenerations. That's the picture. And finally, we have the Cardi condition, which is relating the two ways of... well, since I've got started then on this... let me... I have to say at this point... Greg's not here, so I can say this. I couldn't quite understand. He has a beautiful picture in his lectures. The lectures themselves have developed a mythical importance because they were never published. So the website of KITP is now actually has more citations than many for this particular Cardi condition than many journal articles. But so one of the generations is this. That's where we simply take the annulus and pull it apart into a pair of discs joined at points in the interior. And the other one is this. This is why it's the complexity of this picture, which is a pair of discs joined at two points, but you've got to get the order right. And so this is relating a pair of multiplications in the open sector to a pair of these guys. That's what the Cardi condition does. So anyway, that's the theorem of Llewellyn. I've almost run out of time and I've barely started. Oh dear. Okay, so moving along. I want to talk about closed topological field theory and about how relations among operations come from relations among Dane twists in the mapping class group. So in the open theory, as we've just been seeing, we've been integrating over moduli spaces which are manifolds with boundary. And they're not cycles. They don't represent classes in the absolute homology. But in the theory of closed topological field theory, the moduli spaces don't have boundaries anymore if there's no open sector, if we're not considering open state correlators, I should say. And so we can look for cycles in the moduli spaces and integrate over them and get additional operations beyond just these products. And the most convenient way to do that is to consider Dane twists. So I want to change point of view completely from the first part of the talk and now think about moduli spaces like so, which are moduli spaces of Riemann surfaces of genus G with n boundary components, which are ordered. And I put a conformal structure on it and a parametrization on the boundary. So these are actually the spaces of morphisms in Siegel's category. And so pi 1 of these by a theorem of, I think it's by Dane, although there's some is generated by Dane twists. And in fact, if you take all the Dane twists, so a Dane twist is you take a closed contour in the surface and then you rotate by 2 pi around, that gives you a path in the moduli space, which is closed, and you can also think of it as a component in the diffeomorphism group. So we have this generation, and in fact now all the relations are very elegantly written down, and they all seem to be quite important in topological field theory, so I just wanted to illustrate them. When I say that these Dane twists give rise to operations, I mean that we can take the image of this in H1 of the moduli space. And if we have a one cycle in the moduli space, we can integrate along it. It's a closed contour and it gives some operation. So let me start by illustrating this in the case of the cylinder. So this moduli space M02 hat, this is actually homotopy equivalent to the circle. In particular, H2 of it is zero. So when we do the Dane twist here, we actually are generating pi1 of the circle. And the image of that in H1, that gives us an operation, which will denote the associated operation. In the closed sector, which has ghost number -1, is, I'll call it delta. So the fact that H2 of the circle is 0 implies that delta squared is 0. At least up to BRS exact quantities. Incidentally, it would be interesting to develop the analogous homotopy treatment of all of these identities that we were discussing now for A infinity, and there's certainly been some progress in that, but the full story has not yet been worked out. It's an operation from the physical Hilbert space of the closed sector to itself, which lowers ghost number by one. Operator. Yeah, and it's an operation, it's a unary operation. A multiplication is a binary operation. It has two inputs and one output. Delta has one input and one output. Okay? So now, there's something called the Lantin relation, which was discovered by Dane and then forgotten, and then rediscovered by Johnson, and I don't know whether it was then forgotten. I then just recently discovered that it was, I don't know, not rediscovered, but anyway, Waffer certainly made good use of it. And it relates 7 different Dane twists on this surface. So we have and then some other color. So I can't possibly get all the orientations right and the ordering and everything for this. There's the proof. There's a beautiful proof in a paper of Ivanov. Anyway, the standard, you just need to look at something sort of something like 12 different pictures, one after the other, and see that you get back to where you started after doing these 7 Dane twists. So it's sort of tedious, but possible. So anyway, the basic statement is, roughly speaking, that the product of the green Dane twists equals the product of the red Dane twists. That's the Lantin identity. So product of 3 equals product of 4. And somehow the mismatch between 3 on the left-hand side and 4 on the right-hand side was what Waffer was making use of then to show, for example, that in a rational conformal field theory, the dimensions are rational numbers. So this is a pretty powerful identity. And if we take its image in H1, of M0 4 bar, then we get an identity which says that delta is what's called a Batalin-Vilkovisky operator.
There's a reason why physicists call that BV.
Oh, yeah?
They don't have to learn to spell these names.
Well, I'm not very good at Cyrillic, but this is a statement about delta of a product of three things, and this is where I'm really... So, David, don't ask for the signs here. It says that delta is not a derivation, but instead it's the next step up from being a derivation. It's like a second-order analog of a derivation. It's a second-order operator, exactly, yeah. So this one, let's say that corresponds to the top red Dane twist, the left-hand side. The right-hand side corresponds... then I may have the signs wrong. No, I don't think so. The right-hand side corresponds to these remaining three red Dane twists, their image in H1. And then we have the three green guys, which occur with the opposite sign and involve delta of a pair of things. In three possible ways. Okay, so we have that identity. And that immediately implies that the bracket of A and B, which is delta of AB minus delta of A times B minus A times delta of B, is a Poisson, is a Gerstenhaber bracket. I should be accurate. Which is just a Poisson bracket of degree negative one. And furthermore, maybe I should have mentioned, delta is skew adjoint with respect to the natural pairing. Now, what about in genus 1? Do we get any additional relations among Dane twists? And the remarkable thing is that all the remaining relations among Dane twists are found in the surface of genus 1 with one boundary component. That is, with the exception of some very, very trivial identities. Two disjoint curves on a surface, their Dane twists commute, and if a curve bounds a disk, then its Dane twist is the identity. Apart from that, all of the remaining relations among Dane twists can be seen on this surface. And I'm going to just write down one of them. There are two, but I've lost a run out of time. Now my colors are okay. So the relations are as follows. If this is beta, alpha, and gamma, the relation is S alpha, S beta, S alpha, where S is the Dane twist around that curve, to the fourth power equals S gamma. And again, this is something you check by a lengthy sequence of paying attention to pictures. But it's elementary. And what this says, when you take its image in H1, of M11 hat, it's an identity, a new identity for the Batalin-Vilkovisky operator, which is absolutely not true in every Batalin-Vilkovisky algebra. So it's a strong constraint on Batalin-Vilkovisky algebras of this type, satisfying these identities, which could be the closed sector of a topological field theory. So let me write out in algebraic language what it says. If we take a closed state A and look at its multiplication action, it defines a matrix by multiplying by it on the closed sector, and then we can compose that with the Batalin-Vilkovisky operator. So this term corresponds to the image in H1 of either of these Dane twists, because, of course, these Dane twists are actually conjugate. So they give the same cycle up to an exact cycle. So, and then on the right-hand side, we have the supertrace of on C of multiplication by delta of A. So we get this peculiar identity with this 12th in it, but it's an identity meant to be an identity in algebra. So this identity has recently actually cropped up in a paper of Losev and Shadrin, in which they are coupling topological field theory to topological gravity by a completely explicit formula, and they want to verify the known identities in genus 1 for Gromov-Witten invariants, and so they, or topological gravity, if you prefer, and so they, it turns out they need at some moment to invoke this. I was quite surprised a year ago when they presented this as a new axiom, but I said, no, it's not a new axiom. It just, Dain actually knew this identity also. So I would have gone on and explained the recent results of Costello, but I've mismanaged my time. The statement is the following, though. Suppose we have a Frobenius algebra. So then, okay, am I allowed to, can I have another minute? Okay, and can I use Hochschild cohomology without defining it? So at least... Those of you who know Hochschild cohomology will be able to follow what on earth I'm going to say. There's this algebraic structure which we can associate to associative algebras called Hochschild cohomology, and which generalizes the idea of the center of a associative algebra. So in Moore and Siegel's work, you see the center of the algebra appearing. The natural generalization of that, for example, to the Fourier category, would be the Hochschild cohomology. Absolutely, yeah. So the point is that there is a map from the closed sector to the Hochschild cohomology of the open sector. That's what these cyclohedra are defining for you. The question is, what is the relationship between the closed sector and the Hochschild cohomology?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I should, but I prefer to emphasize the center. Okay, it's also deformations are also in the Hochschild cohomology of the deformations of the Frobenius algebra. So, yeah. So Gerstenhaber showed Hochschild cohomology was a Gerstenhaber algebra, so that it had this bracket. So it already, he already saw it had a piece of the structure. Well, Hochschild, I should say, showed it was a commutative product, an algebra. Gerstenhaber showed that it had this bracket and that it was a commutative algebra. So that's more than 40 years ago. It's already developing structures that we see in topological field theory, well, which we see 25 years later than that. So then I had observed that topological field theories in general have this Bartalan-Wilkowiski operator. Then Chass and Sullivan, essentially, but with further work which generalized their context, they saw that actually the Hochschild cohomology of a Frobenius algebra also has a Bartalan-Wilkowiski operator. It's actually just Kohn's capital B operator. So it's given by an explicit formula. And also there were some efforts to extend that to A infinity algebras. And now recently Kevin Costello has shown, in fact, that the Hochschild cohomology of a Frobenius algebra and more generally of a cyclic A infinity algebra, in particular the Fourier category, is in fact a topological field theory in the suitable axiomatic sense. And he does it by writing down the correct notion of a homotopy topological field theory in the same way that a homotopy associative algebra is an A infinity algebra. You can write down a notion of homotopy topological field theory in a very, very precise way. And it involves trees and graphs and so forth. And then he actually, starting with a cyclic A infinity category, he just writes down what he would guess would be the sort of homotopy topological field theory generated by it. And he does that by gluing disks to very thin annuli. I had some pictures, but I no time. And then shows using some hyperbolic geometry, some very simple geometric ideas, that this is in fact a homotopy topological field theory. And in the last step, he identifies it with the Hochschild cohomology. So in that way, he shows that, for example, remains somewhat mysterious, that the Hochschild cohomology of, say, the Foucault category must satisfy this relation. Well, actually, both sides are zero. So it's not necessarily so immediately useful in practical, in the sort of examples that you're interested in. But as a kind of a result in homotopical algebra, it's a very exciting new idea. Okay, I stop there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
For the truth, whose target is that point?
Yes.
Then, I don't know what you think. I guess you could also consider that the point of the truth, whose target is the point, but also mm-hmm. the point might be
that. Mm-hmm. Matrices. Yeah. 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 Yes.
So in this case, do you is your relation this one top relation?
This is very boring in that case because that's semi-simple, and so all we're doing is starting with, say, matrix algebra. Its Hochschild cohomology is just the complex numbers in degree zero. So delta is automatically zero because it changes the ghost number. And so it would have to go from ghost number zero to ghost number negative one, but that space is zero. So all of this structure collapses. All you're left with is the trivial the center of the matrix algebra. Now, if you then want to go on and couple to topological gravity, so I avoided talking about that in this talk because I didn't want to... First of all, okay, so Kevin Costello has in fact sent me a draft of a proof that you can... I think Konsevich has been lecturing sort of with some increasing precision on some ideas, but Costello actually has a paper now which establishes everything. So he actually then shows that starting with a closed topological field theory and with some additional structure, which roughly speaking says that the circle action on the rotation of the circle that the states are sitting on acts trivially on the physical states, but in a very precise fashion, then you can construct Gromov-Witten invariants. And so that would be the correct... That would have been the talk after which you would have asked this question. But I didn't want to upstage him, apart from anything else, since he hasn't put his paper on the web yet. Yeah. Plus, it's been going through a few iterations. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, now I think if you study Losev and Chadrin's paper, you can certainly see some ideas, a sort of explicit formula for the coupling to topological gravity, which Costello is merely going to be giving you a proof of the existence of. So I think that's the great virtue of their paper. Unfortunately, their paper runs out of steam in the sense that so far, I believe, they really don't understand exactly how to put descendants at more than one of the marked points. But if you're only interested in correlators with descendants at a single marked point, they have a conjecture for all genera. One would guess that the full formula, that there is some formula in general, and that it will precisely involve the tau function of the pure topological gravity, but they haven't yet found such a formula. It might be very hard to do so. But if you study their formula for genus 1, topological gravity, it's a sum over graphs with one loop. And so very, very natural. And the graphs are the same as the ones that occur in Baranikov and Koncevich which I believe Koncevich at least said was the same action as the Kadira-Spencer field theory. Does that sound plausible? Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, so Losev and Chadrin are now pushing forward to the semi-classical approximation.